Our goal is to bring you the news, talk about stories that the mainstream media isn't covering. We are out of Iraq.
No, that's not true.
That is true.
That just means you're in love with Richard Engel.
Welcome, new listeners. We're men. Cupcakes? Oh, how do I get pregnant?
You can't, son. And a voice says,
say a command. Papa.
Oh, shit.
Bark, bark, papa.
Is it APAC, L?
APAC.
Lizards.
King of the Dolphins.
They say, support the troops, and then they send them off to be massacred.
Yeah, all of the UK protesters, you guys are badasses.
Big Brother coming in. Big Brother's got his hand up your vag.
Oh, seriously.
Israel commits war crimes.
Who wants to hear about the deficit?
I'm a dollar sign, and I'm kind of sad. Bad things happen to me.
Goldman Sachs is inside the White House administration. Sexually.
Legally, you don't have the right to do that. Wink. You don't.
Wink.
Well, snizzage.
That's like a widget, but for you, snizzy. Death by archery.
Wow. That would be amazing. Constantly hugging and peeing.
It's so odd that, you know, Democrats get looked down upon for offering entitlements, for helping people. That's what entitlements are, by the way. It's helping people.
Citizen Radio.
Citizen Radio.
Citizen Radio.
Citizen Radio.
Citizen Radio.
We are citizensradio.com.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Citizen Radio.
DIY Radio, broadcasting from the People's Republic of the Internet.
It is Tuesday, March 29th. I'm one of your hosts, Jamie Kilstein.
And I'm Allison Kilkenny.
You can find us at WeAreCitizenRadio.com. Subscribe to the show for free at WeAreCitizenRadio.com. And find Allison and I on Facebook and Twitter. Hey, Allison.
Hi, Jamie.
What's the matter?
Do you have a little trouble?
All right, so here's what happened. Is I had this plan in my head. I was going to try to be really sweet. And instead of saying the date, I was going to say, it's some fucking date and some day and you can find us at some website, but it doesn't matter because Allison just did Democracy Now!
Yeah.
But then I realized, because you did Democracy Now!, we probably have a lot of new listeners.
That's true.
A lot of very intelligent listeners.
They are a smart crowd.
And if they heard the opening of the show, just me fumbling, oh, there's some fucking bullshit. And then, so I panicked in the middle, realized that was a terrible idea, dove for my phone to find out what the date actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are, 25 minutes later, after explaining how I do the introduction.
I think it was time well spent.
Hello, Allison.
Hi, Jamie.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. And thanks to everybody at Democracy Now!
Wow, that was very unemotional. You realize I... So Democracy Now! Is the reason I became political.
That's true. When we were on the road, before we had a home, pre-home,
I was doing stand-up gigs.
Right.
Allison, I believe, was trying to write a novel.
Oh, you know what I was doing? Nothing. That's what I was doing. Not a thing.
And we go...
observing life.
Yeah. And we go to Columbus, Ohio.
Yes.
Oh, no. Cincinnati. I'm sorry. Land of Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah, that's right.
That's how I'll remember. And someone was like, hey, have you ever watched Democracy Now? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I know about politics. And he turned it on and I was like, oh my God, the world is ending.
We don't know anything.
We need to act immediately.
Yeah.
And so I got a little emotional today. I didn't get to see Allison. She didn't allow me to go.
Look, I didn't ban you. Here's what happened.
She banned me from Democracy Now!
Thank God I did this, because I was afraid that Jamie, I was going to make eye contact with him and just start laughing, because that happens to us all the time.
We do this thing in yoga where whenever everyone's very serious, we will make a face like the other one is about to throw up and try to get the other one to break and start laughing in a 107-degree yoga room.
Yeah, I can't explain it, but it's the funniest thing ever. So
move over, Bill Cosby. Why didn't he just do that? The pretend to throw up kind of...
I don't know. Not a visionary like us.
His loss.
I guess. So the new studio has a huge glass window where the guests sit on the other side and watch the show as it's being taped. So if I had looked over and seen your face, I assume you would have just pressed your face against the glass like a child.
Because that's the best way to enjoy glass.
See, I know you very well. And I would have lost it on Democracy Now! On my first appearance.
Thrown up on Amy.
On Democracy. Yeah, and then thrown up on Amy.
Instead, she was amazing. And so I didn't go. I was at Muay Thai fighting dudes.
No big deal.
No big deal, you guys. Just throwing around 6'2" guys.
You're
like
pretty
I
much
owned them.
Defending us from giant men.
Right.
Yeah.
So while Allison was covering the protests, I'm practicing for the eventual civil war caused by the protests.
Right.
So I'll be prepared. time well spent. Anyway, so I start walking and I see Democracy Now! Tweeted Allison and said, or no, I'm sorry, tweeted up next, Allison Kilkenny from Citizen Radio. And look, guys, maybe it's because The National was playing on my iPod. And if I saw a tweet that said fart, fart, pee, pee, I still would have cried. But I got a little emotional. I'm very proud of you.
Thank
Allison
you.
Went from living on the road, in the car, you know, watching Democracy Now!, wondering what she wants to do, if she wants to write fiction or politics. She started writing about politics. She got really, really good at it. And I don't know. I was just super proud of you. And you did awesome. You did even better than I thought you
Thank
would do.
Thank you. Let me walk you through what happened to me.
All right.
So I get there.
Because I was pretty relaxed.
I get there about 6 hours early.
Right. Now, what the listeners might not know is that is a passive-aggressive shot towards me because I told her to leave that early.
Yeah. Wasn't actually 6 hours. I got there probably 40 minutes early. So I wanted to leave at a much later time. That would have gotten me there.
They get it.
Right on
They
time.
Get it. I was wrong.
Oh, no. I meant to tell you this. Actually, you were right. I got to go up earlier because I got there early. And Johan called in early, I guess.
Good buddy of the show, Johan Hari, was also on Allison's Democracy Now! TV debut, which was exciting.
So we actually got bumped up and we got to go earlier, which was nice. I didn't have to sit there and just, you know, sweat drops of
right.
terror.
So can I take down the sign that said you were wrong, Jamie?
No, now? We're going to leave that up.
Because I'm going to be... Are you foreshadowing that I'm going to be wrong about something else?
Soon, yeah.
I'm not going to be.
See, you were already wrong.
That's true.
So the sign stays.
All right.
So I get there...
It's just mean.
6.5 hours early.
Okay.
And I go to get tea, and as I'm crossing the road...
Fancy!
This car, I think what the kids call a sweet ride.
Okay.
It's a really nice car, tinted windows, uh-huh. really nice rims, mm-hmm. runs a light, and almost mows me down.
Did you scream, get off my lawn?
No, I stopped, like, made... Like, what I assume was eye contact because I couldn't see through the tinted glass
okay.
with the driver. And then very slowly kept walking but maintained eye contact
oh,
the entire
work.
Time. Now, my immediate thought after what a dick was, what if that was Amy Goodman?
Right. If you just stare
just
down.
In her sweet ass pimp ride.
Now, what would have made it worse? What would have been worse for you mentally? To see your political hero in that kind of car... No regard for the law, running red lights, or the fact that Amy Goodman now just saw her guest stare her down and give her the stink eye.
I think they're both equally scary. But here's what I immediately realized after I thought that. Allison, that's absurd. Amy Goodman's already taping Democracy Now!
Was it Juan
Next
Gonzalez?
Thought, yes. Next thought, what if it's Juan Gonzalez? What if I just challenged Juan Gonzalez non-verbally to a death match? What do?
That is what that means. When you stare at someone, that is, in certain parts of the world, looking at you, Mississippi, a challenge for a death match.
Yeah. And in retrospect, it would make much more sense that Juan would have the sweet-ass pimp ride versus...
Because of all that daily news money?
Yeah! Raking in the money, that sweet, sweet journalism cash.
Right.
That we just spend on fur coats and cars.
That's true.
And the ladies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
Now, I'm glad you said that because as listeners and for new listeners who have found us through Democracy Now!, hello, my name is Jamie Kilstein. I do stand-up comedy. Sometimes I get on TV, mostly in other countries. Allison, you met this morning or yesterday morning, and we have a radio show, and this is a free radio show. And we have huge guests like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and Amy Goodman and Rachel Maddow. And all sorts of really cool people. And sometimes, usually in the beginning of the show, we just kind of riff about nothing and warm up a little bit.
Yeah, we call it the douchebag buffer, meaning if you can't get through 20 minutes that isn't about you or something immediately of importance to you.
Probably a douchebag.
Yeah, probably a douchebag. It's
Many
okay.
Many of you are turning it off now.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, but you just have to live with the knowledge that you are a douchebag. Now, if you can get through the 20 minutes, we have really interesting guests. We talk about political issues. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating show.
We've started a little community. We have quite the bustling forum on wearecitizenradio.com. We like to consider ourselves sort of radio for outcasts. We have a huge LGBT community, a vegan community, an atheist community, and just a ton of progressives. Some people are new to politics. Some people have, you know, march marched against the Vietnam War, and people are starting to become friends, and we have meetups and do shows.
Yeah,
for
it's
them
very
and-
cool. But for example, today we're going to interview a big old animal rights activist.
Yes, Gary Francione. Actually, a little controversial. Mm-hmm. In the animal rights movement, but he used to clerk for Sandra Day O'Connor and then was the lawyer that represented PETA in like its first kind of groundbreaking huge case when they occupied this school that was testing, doing medical tests or scientific research by bashing the heads in of baboons.
Ooh, that's not nice.
Not a good thing. And since then, he's split from PETA and actually has many problems with the animal welfare community that want to ease the suffering of animals but still watch them be murdered for us.
So in other words, instead of like, hey, instead of cutting the heads off of chickens, why don't we gas them? Because that's so much more humane.
You know, like Hitler.
Right. Yeah.
So, so we're going to talk to Gary. I don't know if we're going to have time to do it today. We're interviewing him right after the show. So we'll either air it today, and if we don't, we'll air it on tomorrow's episode. And then upcoming guest, David Sirota, is going to be on the show. Chris Hayes is going to be on the show. Gideon Levy, the Israeli journalist from Haaretz, who is a hero / one of the most hated men in Israel. And so that's us. That's what we do. Now, for anyone who listens to the show regularly, you'll know that every time I get on an airplane, I look at Allison, who looks annoyed, and I say, I love you, not because I love her, which I do, but because I assume once that airplane goes in the air, we're all going to die.
Right.
Some people call me morose.
You tend to think that regardless, though. I think like every time we get on a subway, you assume it's going to crash and we're all going to die.
Well, and every time something good happens.
Yeah.
So I assume, like, my grandma's about to die. I've slowly started distancing myself from her.
Jamie cannot cope with death. And instead of facing death like an adult, he just ignores old people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. And so when you said the car thing, suddenly I didn't feel so stupid because I'm like, oh, Allison's about to accomplish one of her dreams. She's probably going to die. So if you noticed when we were leaving today, when I was leaving the house to go to Muay Thai, Allison was very serious in preparing for the show, not in the mood for me being all clingy. And I was desperately trying to hold her and tell her how much I loved her because I thought she was going to die.
Yeah.
So congratulations on Democracy Now! And more so, congratulations for not dying, which would, of course, lead me to a homicidal rage.
Right. I've survived another day. If I've accomplished nothing else, oftentimes at the end of a day, I think, well, at least I didn't die.
Did I die? Nope. Still
nope.
Here? All
Check.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Now, I got some stuff to talk about.
Holy crap. Okay, go ahead.
No, I don't. So here's what happened. I do, actually. So
I do have something as well. Just, I'm not saying we need a backup, but I'm just saying I'm prepared to speak if... I'm just saying if shit goes down.
I see you made a sign telling me that you were ready to speak.
Often at the end of the day, I think, did I die? Nope. Did I make fabulous signs? Check.
Yeah, but you could just tell me these things instead of having that constant reminder.
Here's what I feel. I feel signs really hammer home the point and you remember it much more clearly than if I just say it and you could forget. If you have to stare at it all day, I think it sinks in.
Can I ask a question about the signs?
Yes.
When did you get a picture of me crying and why are they stapled to every sign?
About 3 months ago.
Okay.
And do I really have to say why? So you remember.
Is it so I fear you?
A little.
Because I think
I think
when you took that picture, now that you say 3 months ago, I think I was crying because of one of your other signs.
Yeah, I believe you're right. I don't know. Is it so you'll fear me or respect me? And are those two things mutually exclusive? I think there's a little bit of respect in fear and a little bit of fear in respect.
Spoken like a true Republican.
That's true.
All right. Let's hear your story.
I'm not a Republican, everybody. Just in case there's new.
Oh, yeah. We are sometimes sarcastic. Some would call it comedy. And a lot of times
others would call it the most offensive and horrific thing they've ever heard in their life.
A lot of our little progressives, they're not used to people who agree with them. So they're a little on edge. And sometimes we say something and they think we meant it another way. They didn't catch the sarcasm. So sometimes after we say something very sarcastic, we'll honk. That was one of our fans' ideas. Just honk. So that happens.
Oh, do I need to honk? So nobody... Here we go.
Israel is a peaceful nation.
Honk.
See? There it is.
Yeah. That meant it was sarcasm. We don't actually believe that.
They're not really. A lot of Israelis are. A lot of Israelis want peace. My family, Jewish, very peaceful.
See? No honking. That was a genuine comment.
That was genuine, you guys.
Yeah. All right.
So hopefully we don't have to walk you through it for long.
I think that was pretty clear.
New people, you'll catch up. You'll catch up.
If you guys need me to make a sign, I will.
Don't do it. Don't ask her to make a sign.
If you guys want me to, I will.
Guys, they hurt so bad.
But you remember. You remember.
They really make you feel like less of a person.
That's what learning feels like.
Nope, just hurt. Devastating anguish.
I think what you meant is an education.
Lots of pain.
Education.
Actually feel your heart breaking.
Well,
do you remember when you actually heard Ralph Wiggum's heartbreak on The Simpsons? Was you think,
meh?
It's that.
You didn't hear it. You could see it.
Oh, that's right. Bart played it back in slow motion.
Yeah. Frame by frame when his heart tore in half.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Let's get to your story because there's a lot of pressure on mine and I don't know if it holds up to yours.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the enormous anti-austerity cut protest that just happened in the UK.
Okay.
We talked a lot about the US uncut protests because I was covering them for The Nation, but I just wanted to give a massive shout out to all of the people who went out and protest. 500,000 people.
And my mom.
And Jamie Kilstein's mother.
My mother from New Jersey was over there.
Now, do you remember the ad nauseum coverage of the Tea Party movement on the U.S. news?
You mean when Glenn Beck tried to, on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday,
yes,
stand on the same steps?
Yeah. Not that many people there.
Now, didn't he, real quick, just to clarify, didn't he, because once he realized... Because he said he did it by accident. Once he realized it was on Martin Luther King Day, didn't he say like he'd move two steps down to honor King?
I don't know if it was two steps, but that was the general idea that he would not stand where Martin Luther King Jr. stood. He would stand in a different spot out of respect.
Do you think he stood down because he assumed that King should have been on the back of the steps?
We would have to ask Glenn. I don't know.
Bam. Get it?
So nonstop coverage of that. And many of these Tea Party protests, there weren't a tremendous amount of people there.
No, and not only nonstop. I mean, the mainstream media, a lot of times, even when they are showing a center-right or right-wing agenda, they will still point to Glenn Beck and kind of make fun of him. Where they're like, well, it's not like we're Glenn Beck over here. And yet... just because of ratings, they will cover it, yeah, like it is the civil rights movement.
Right. Now...
for white people.
500,000 people were in the streets.
Here's what I saw on the news. A dude throwing a bottle.
Yeah, and there was a very small block of so-called anarchists who decided to come out and cause trouble, and the media tried to use them to delegitimize the entire movement. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't cover things like that when they happen, but don't... exclusively cover that.
Well, what bothered me the most is the label or the header for a lot of the coverage was violent protests break out in London as opposed to most of the country marches for their benefits.
Yeah. Now, another important point was there were hundreds of people arrested during this protest. And so imagine that you're sitting at home and all you're seeing of the coverage of the protest is these anarchists. You would assume that the 100+ people who were arrested were all anarchists causing trouble, inflicting violence, destroying property. When in fact, the hundreds of people who were arrested, and this is according to multiple sources, were peaceful protesters. You know, the anti-austerity movement is overwhelmingly a peaceful movement. UK Uncut is an overwhelmingly peaceful protest. None of the anarchists on the news were from UK Uncut, you know? So it just sort of skews the coverage. It warps the meaning of the movement in people's minds so that they start to assume that these are just kids who want to go out and fuck shit up. When in fact, this is a patriotic movement. You know, people, they want to... preserve education for future generations so their country can remain competitive. And so, you know, they can live happy lives. And it's really unfortunate that a small group you know, worked to delegitimize the entire movement. Not only that, but then the media acted as an accomplice to that.
Right. We had this interesting conversation yesterday where I'm reading this new book called The Fighter's Heart, and it's all about this journalist who wanted to become a fighter. So he flew to Thailand and wanted to be a Thai fighter, and then he started training with Pat Militage and a bunch of UFC guys. And it was funny because he started off in the Marines, and I'm like, oh, am I going to have to get through this kind of pro-war meathead because I want to read a book about fighting? And then he talked about once he went to college and learned about the wars and why we caused the wars, he suddenly had this incredibly progressive anti-war paragraph where he's like, I'm not going to work for the machine, and like, you know, everything we say on the show. And then he had like this crazy anarchist phase where he was temping, and he would like, his brother was like a computer programmer and was like, can you write me a virus so I can like take down this place? And like, he just went batshit crazy, right? So anyway, so I'm talking to Ali about it, and oh my god, where was I going with this?
I have no idea. So I was talking about the UK austerity protest, the anarchist,
right,
delegitimizing.
And you brought up this really interesting point when I said after he left college, he was suddenly against these wars, where you were like, yeah, college will do that to you. And there's part of me, I know this is probably a little silly and vague, and it might even sound conspiratorial, but do you think there is part, maybe even subconsciously, of Republicans that know the more, if you look at polls, the most educated people are liberal, and the least educated a lot of times are Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that there's a chance that they are happily cutting education benefits because they're like, well, if they don't get into college,
I mean, that's patently not a conspiracy theory. It's been established.
Really?
Yeah, that they have gone to war with the so-called liberal higher education institutions that they've always hated, even the Ivy League schools.
I know they've always hated it. I just didn't know if there was like a direct correlation where they're like, shut down the schools, make people stupid, they vote for us.
It's not that they, I mean,
I know they don't sit in a back room talking about that.
They definitely want to defund the liberal aspects of an education.
Well, and the
certainly.
Liberal aspects, by the way, it's not people saying, you know, vote Kennedy. The liberal aspects are history,
yeah,
science,
and they would also,
sex education.
They'd also love to get rid of tenure for professors because oftentimes, you know, professors, once they have tenure, they really open up and tell you what they think.
Hi,
you know?
Bill.
And some professors are extremely liberal, especially in higher education institutions. I'm not saying that they're a monolith. You know, there are conservative professors as well. But yeah, the Republicans would love to have the right to fire professors at every whim.
Right.
You know, they would just love it if they had that control. So they hate tenure.
If that was a job,
yeah.
Like a professor firer.
Yeah, they hate how liberal institutions tend to, education institutions tend to circle the wagons when a professor is, cornered. And that doesn't always happen, by the way. Look what happened to Norman Finkelstein.
Right.
You know, sometimes they really hang them out to dry. But
another tenured professor, by the way, leading the charge. Alan Dershowitz leading the charge against Norman Finkelstein.
Hi, Alan.
Hello.
But oftentimes the deans really go to bat for their professors.
Sure.
And they say they have to have, you know, the right to say whatever they feel or believe. And
in a free society.
Exactly.
Weird.
Exactly. Freedom of speech, you know, applies to professors as well. Although Republicans and some Democrats have fought that right as well, that students and professors shouldn't have the right to free speech when they're on, in school, that it no longer applies to them. Yeah.
Craziness.
Yeah.
So I wanted to, you know, off of that, like, I just got a really interesting email, speaking of Norman Finkelstein. So we talked about, I think it was yesterday, it was maybe yesterday or Friday show, we kind of gave like a little primer on Israel-Palestine, because a lot of times we do make comments about the Zionism movement that we in no way want people to think. Like, if you're not educated on the situation, like, for a long time, I don't know if I ever said this on the show, I thought Zionism, like that word, I thought it was a derogatory term for Jew.
Oh, I always used to think it was like a conspiracy theory. It was the people who were like, the Jews run the media.
Yeah. You know, that's what I thought too.
I always thought it was some just like right-wing loony jargon. You know?
Turns out it's real.
Yeah, well, I mean, it just essentially means to people who believe that Israel, that land is their birthright.
Yeah. And so, you know, we talked about very candidly on the show, we had a long conversation about how obviously we are not pro Hamas. We are pro democratically elected leaders. And unfortunately, because of the horrible restrictions that Israel is making on Palestine, blocking a lot of their food and aid and killing people, that had drove a lot of people to vote for Hamas because, you know, Mahmoud Abbas was not really doing anything and Hamas came along and said, we'll protect you. So they voted for them. A lot of them voted for them out of desperation. And so it's obviously a very complicated issue that is not covered well in the United States. So anyway, so we talked about that a lot. And what originally brought it up was somebody wrote in and was like, what the fuck is going on with Bill Maher?
Right.
He comes out against all of these religions, but is being fucking crazy when it comes to Muslims and is essentially, you know, doing the Sam Harris and treating them like they're not actual people and defending Israel.
I like that. Doing the Sam Harris.
Yeah. And defending Israel to it, like unquestionably. Defending everything Israel has done, and which was weird because a lot of what Israel does is because of religion. It's because of the same superstitions that Bill Maher criticizes on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, right? So this guy Ari writes in, and the subject is, not all stubborn Zionists are religious. And he goes, I'm definitely in your camp when it comes to the discrimination against and attacks towards Palestinian civilians at the hands of the Israeli army and government. But you guys repeatedly define Zionism as a religious movement without really talking about the other secular half, which is just as dangerous. This is a quote. We've all been the victims of oppression for thousands of years, so we won't give up what little ground we now have at all costs. End quote. It's easy enough as atheists to dismiss the attitude that Jews have a divine right to the land of Israel, but that's not really going to make any real change. It's very difficult to change powerfully religious politics because one side will always say, stop it, there is no God, and the other will always say, yes, there is, and I know I'm right. It's a stalemate. I'd love to hear you guys tear into the complicated politics involved in the issue. It's very difficult for Israel to play fair because its enemies, the real ones, not innocent civilians who get caught in the middle, don't play fair. Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, etc. They don't exactly have the UN human rights during wartime rules in their corner. Israel is so terrified to lose at all that they're doing despicable things like allowing Palestinian children to die during conflicts. I don't think it's right at all, but I would really appreciate it if you guys gave this issue a bit more depth when you talk about it on Citizen Radio. I know they're all about making sure different sides aren't seen as monoliths. Thanks for your time. I hope this email wasn't too long, Ari. Sure. So we're going to get into this pretty heavily with Gideon Levy next week. So we're not going to go like crazy into it, but I think, was he just asking to point out that, like, I got the first half. The first half seemed like he was just asking to point out that it's not just about religion. And that actually makes it more dangerous, almost, where it's like, the religious people, all religions, you believe crazy shit, right? So whether you're a Christian who hates gays, whether you're a Jew who believes God promised you this land, whether you're a Muslim that thinks that women should be stoned to death for adultery. Now, obviously, this is a minority of every religion, but all the religions believe crazy shit. However, the Zionism, the secular Zionism, sounds much more like American imperialism, which is super dangerous.
What immediately came to my mind was the fact that, so what it sounds like the point he was trying to make is, though it may have started as a religious thing. It's now been institutionalized to the point where it's a secular movement and national policy. And he's absolutely right to make that point. You know, it's sort of like slavery in the United States. It technically started as a biblical thing.
Right.
You know, but then it just became an institutionalized thing.
It became an asshole thing.
Where people weren't thinking like, God said I can do this when they were buying and selling black people, but that might have been how it started.
Right.
But you're right. It almost is more dangerous when it becomes a secular national policy because it's so much more sterilized.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, where people, it's not as immediately absurd in a modern culture. Like if someone tried to occupy Palestinian land and said, God said I could do it, that person might sound crazy, but if that person walks onto Palestinian land and says, Israel policy, this is my land, it's much more sterile in the sense that it's law.
Yeah.
And it's official, and it's much more hard to combat that kind of reasoning.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, something that I think one of the things that breaks my heart the most about the conflict in Israel-Palestine is what that quote Ari sent me. Because in the beginning, you can become so empathetic, where it says the Jews have been persecuted for thousands of years. And that is 100% true. And you see something like that and you're like, oh my God, you know, I can almost understand being so scared and paranoid when they are threatened by people like, you know, Al-Qaeda or Hamas. But then what completely breaks my heart and discredits that is if those people, if their only motives are the fact that they're scared and that they're trying to defend themselves, and as some of them say, they're trying to prevent a second Holocaust, the second so many civilians are massacred, the second you realize that with a wall, you were creating the same kind of apartheid that has hurt so many minorities on the planet, that you would turn around and say, because I was oppressed, I'm not going to be on the other side. I'm not going to oppress other people at the stake of my so-called safety, or for the sake of my safety. That just breaks my heart. That kills me. Because it's just like, because you were persecuted for so long of anybody, you should not be. I mean, that's one of, you know, I'm an atheist, but I'm definitely like was raised. I mean, I have a long Jewish heritage. And that's one of the things that I'm really proud of when it comes to being Jewish, is the fact that it's like, yeah, my ancestors were persecuted, so I'm going to fight with every, you know, ounce of strength I have to make sure that doesn't happen to other people.
Not only that, the Jewish community has a really proud tradition of defending people who were being persecuted. So the Jewish people were a huge ally during the civil rights movement.
My grandmother said she wants to be reincarnated as a black person. And it was awesome.
Yeah, she did say that. But, I mean, there is a proud Jewish tradition of standing up for persecuted minorities precisely for the reason you just said.
Which is just so glaringly fucking obvious.
Yeah.
That's what kills me.
Well, that's what happens when racism or Zionism becomes institutionalized. Yeah. Those blatant hypocrisies just aren't as obvious to people because they've grown up with these policies. And suddenly, what it means to be Israeli is to persecute Palestinians.
You know, I mean, one of the scariest things about that is this required military service you have in Israel, right? Mm-hmm. Because we've talked about this on the show where obviously Allison and I are very against the wars. But there have been times where, you know, I've been confronted by a lot of soldiers because I talk about the war on stage. And I've had a lot of really great soldiers who agree with me. I've had a lot of really great ones who didn't know the stuff I was talking about and were very intellectually curious. And then I've had a lot of ones who were like, I'm going to kick your Jew. And they're just fucking furious, right? And when I've talked to the really angry ones, they are peddling bullshit that sounds like it's coming out of the mouth of a child, where they're like, oh, if I wasn't over there, Osama would be in this comedy club right now killing Jews. I mean, it's just like that level of ridiculous that if we're not over there, they're all going to fucking fly over here like battle Los Angeles and the Arabs will turn into weird robots and Aaron Eckhart will be shouting cliches in the corner.
So you're saying that's definitely not going to happen?
That is not. I'm 98% sure it's not going to happen.
All right. I like those odds.
Right. They're pretty good. They're pretty fantastic. And, but again, you have to kind of put aside your anger and take a second to empathize with these guys where it's like, okay, why are they being such morons? Is it because they're stupid?
Why are they ignorant?
Why are they ignorant?
Yeah.
That's a nicer way to put it.
Yeah.
And part of my answer was, I think if I were over in Iraq and Afghanistan, I would, and one of my friends died, or I almost died, or I was injured, or one of my friends was injured, there was part of me that I don't know if I could be brave enough to be some of these soldiers who stood up and said the war was immoral. There's part of me that thinks if I saw my fucking friend die, I would do everything in my power to convince myself that this is a just war and that I'm defending my friend's honor and that I'm doing the right thing. And a lot of times that's what the military can do to people. And the really brave soldiers who come out of it and still question the war get more credit than any civilian can, because basic training is literally trying to breed that out of you. It's trying to breed the originality and breed the personality out of you. So when you think about it with Israel, when you are required to join the military, when you are legally required to join the military, that automatically breeds in that same kind of don't question authority, you are fighting for the good of your country
mentality.
Anybody who's not a Jew is after you.
Yeah.
And that's really dangerous, because I've had conversations, the political conversations I have that devolve the quickest are Israel-Palestine, because it literally, you're talking to them and you're like, you're not hearing anything I'm saying. And it's because of just fucking decades of that just hammering it in.
Well, it's also the assumption that if you attack the policies of Israel, you're an anti-Semite.
Yeah, I'm an anti-Semite because I don't like Jews. Honk, honk.
Honk, everybody. It's a joke. Yeah, but I think people do automatically leap to that assumption because it's an easy way out of an intellectually complex issue.
Yes.
It's a really easy way. It's like saying when you're debating anything to do with war, to say, you know,
you're against the troops,
or this guy's like Hitler. As soon as you play the Hitler or the Nazi card, right, you call somebody a Nazi. It's a conversation ender.
Right.
There's nowhere to go after that, because a Nazi is the worst thing in the world. Hitler is the worst person in the world.
Allison is calling me a Nazi, I would say 19 times a day.
I have a sign that says Jamie equals Nazi.
No, you don't. Oh, yeah, you do.
Yep. Framed and everything.
It's me crying,
mm-hmm,
equals the Nazi symbol.
Yes.
And then equals Hitler. So I'm equal to the Nazi. Just in case I didn't understand.
I like to be thorough in my sign making.
Oh, and you took my favorite poster down to put it up?
Yep, that's right.
Where's the poster?
I don't know. I think I threw it out.
What? Is this post-democracy now, Allison? Is this what's going to happen?
Did you see that I was wearing a blazer?
You were wearing a blazer.
Mm-hmm.
I meant to tell you this. It was pretty badass how you had kind of like this like punk rock t-shirt,
mm-hmm,
and the blazer over it.
Mm-hmm.
Killer look.
Mainly I was wearing a blazer.
Okay, all right.
Which means I'm allowed to do whatever I want.
Somebody told Allison once upon a time that if she wears a blazer, she can get away with anything.
And that person was right, because I've been doing it no one has stopped me.
I'm pretty sure that person was Allison. I'm pretty sure you told yourself that. Got another email.
Oh my goodness.
So this is from, so he gave himself a pretty ballsy nickname.
Oh, goodness.
Dave the Baby Oracle.
What?
It's sort of adorable, though. Hold on. I think he's younger. Hold on.
Oh, my God.
He's 16. That
Hold
just
on.
Means he admires Daniel Burke.
But I want to point out, Daniel Burke earned that name.
But Baby Oracle means he's going to earn it by growing into it.
He aspires to be Big Oracle.
He aspires to take out Daniel Burke the Oracle.
Well, I think you know what you have to do, Dan.
Start training, buddy. Dun, 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 dun. All right. So this is a really sweet email, actually. So, dear Allison and Jamie, if anyone doesn't know, the Oracle, Daniel Burke, was a fan, just a hoodlum member of the show, called us when we were in Australia, was desperately trying to get attention to the refugee system, the refugee prisons in Australia, the horrible conditions these people who did nothing but try to swim for their lives were undertaking. And
he invited Jamie and I to go to Villawood Detention Center.
And I said, hey, Allison, a stranger wants to pick us up in their car
and take us to a prison.
Sound good?
Yep.
And then we got a little recorder and we interviewed him, and he was amazing.
Yeah.
And has a huge fan base on the show. Hoodlum, Dan the Oracle. Baby Oracle, are you even a fucking member? I'm sorry. I don't know if you remember me, but you read an email of mine 5 months ago. Allison, you got that?
Where am I?
At that point, I had been listening to Citizen Radio for about 2 weeks, and I was thinking about becoming a vegetarian because of your promotion of animal rights. So I would like to thank you for all you are doing. It is truly amazing. I am a 16-year-old vegetarian atheist who every day gets more political. Your show is like a second home where I can come to and feel special. If only I had a job, I would immediately become a member.
All right. I like you again, baby Oracle.
Sorry. Actually, you're regular Oracle. Dan, you're demoted. I'm just kidding.
Never.
I'm just kidding.
Dan, I'll make a new sign.
He can be...
Don't you worry.
Baby Oracle can be like Robin to Dan's Batman.
Or a baby Oracle to a regular size Oracle.
Batman to Robin. I stand by it. That's awesome, man. Yeah, we've gotten... I literally have hundreds of emails I haven't read from people. And
we
that's
know.
The first thing people...
We know.
Okay. And that's the first thing people say when they meet us. Is we become a vegetarian because of you, and we feel so much better. And, you know, once reading up on it, we couldn't believe that we were eating animals that were tortured. I mean, you guys also remember, this is something Gary said in an interview, and maybe he'll say it again on the show, but when it comes to dairy and stuff, he's like, what do you think happens to those animals when they're done with them? Do you think they just let them go?
Right.
Like, they kill them.
Thank you, cow.
Like,
you've worked very hard.
Yeah, like, what?
Now to the retirement home.
Do you like cow bingo? I hope you do. Maybe your cow grandchildren will come to visit. Probably not. They're busy in the workforce. It's a tough... I'm sorry. I got long and complicated. Yeah, they... You know, the... When male chickens are born in factory farms that produce eggs, they're immediately thrown into a fucking trash compactor.
Right.
Because they're not... useful.
Not going to lay eggs themselves.
They are not.
Unless they're a very special man chicken.
Or a crafty. If I were a chicken.
Would you make like fake eggs?
I would be the Jason Bourne of chickens.
Yeah. I would just try to disguise any object I found around me as an egg.
Lots of
like,
people.
Eh? Anytime yeah. a farmer walked by.
Lots of people.
Look what I made.
Many citizens would be eating chicken Jamie and Allison poop. Because that would be our plan. I would just.
We would be the worst chickens. At the chicken, we would get fired from the chicken hen house.
At the very least, our pay would be cut.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. They don't have pay because they're slaves, and then they're murdered.
Right.
Anyway, I think what's even more like the picture that's made me the most uncomfortable about when they disregard the baby male chicks is sometimes they don't put them in. So putting them in a fucking shredder.
Pretty harsh.
Gruesome enough, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes they just throw them in a dumpster and they suffocate or eat each other because it's just a pile, which is infinitely worse, I think. It's just a more horrible image. Just a dumpster of alive chicks and dead chicks.
It's like a worse Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, I'd say it's a little worse. Not as much character development, a lot more suffocating.
I'm picturing a piggy little chicken with the glass. Was that piggy?
I'm going to be honest with you.
I don't know.
Was assigned the book in sixth grade. Didn't read a page. Should have. Heard it's good.
That sounds right.
So anyway, Dave, congratulations, man, and keep it up. I wish, and I'm not just saying this because we were, for some reason, sort of snarky and mean in the beginning of your very kind email. I wish I was half as intelligent as you were when I was 16, but I was just a stoned glob of laziness and didn't give a shit about anybody. Although I did try to be a vegetarian.
I'm always amazed when people write in who are like, I'm 15 or 16 and they're like that politically engaged. Cause you're right. At 16, I didn't know anything. Like, I want to go back in time so I can find my 16-year-old self and just slap her.
Yeah. I wanted to know, especially because that 16-year-old wouldn't know how to defend a slap.
And also wasn't making signs. I want to be like, get on your sign making abilities early.
Yes.
And also buy a blazer.
Yeah. And like, you know, it's one of those things where I'm like, what did I know? I knew how to gossip. I knew who was going to shoot rubber bands at me. Yet didn't know enough to avoid them since it happened every day.
How to roll a joint.
Never learned. Would always make my friends do it.
Oh, that's right. You were the moocher.
I was that guy. Yeah. Didn't have a bowl, couldn't afford weed.
Ooh, we would not have brought you to Wendy's with us.
But I was in the band.
Do you guys take money from Wendy's?
No, no, we don't. We don't go. God damn it. Fuck all of you. We do not support fast food. We do not eat fast food.
All right.
It is gross. So anyway, so yeah, congratulations. So this leads into a really interesting topic, which was being parents who are vegan and how to raise your kid. And here's why I think it's so interesting. I think it's so interesting because, like, I care more about other people than myself. It's no big deal, you guys. I'm just...
You know you're not supposed to, like, announce that.
I'm pretty much like that's Martin, like, Luther King Jr.
That's an observation others are supposed to make for you. You're not supposed to say, I'm such a selfless person.
Guys, when I give a speech on Martin Luther King's birthday, I'm going to stand on the step above him just because I'm great. And I'm just a sweet guy. I'm a sweet guy. I'm healthy.
You know Martin Luther King Jr. still isn't standing on the step.
I'm really funny.
It's not like a taxidermist stuffed him and put him on the step and he's still there.
Then who did I put my arm around and have you take a picture of? Was that just a black guy?
That's a black guy.
That is insulting.
Yeah, it is.
Well, sir, if you are listening to this program, I apologize.
Mm.
Who is the other guy that I thought was Malcolm X?
Another black guy.
Not the same guy, though.
No, different one.
Oh, thank God.
There's more than one black guy.
Were they in the same family?
No, they don't know each other.
Okay. Still probably confusing for both of them.
They were definitely confused. I think a little angry.
Yeah, they weren't smiling, but I thought it was like the kind of tough guy Malcolm pose.
No, they were just two angry human beings. And I, quite frankly, don't blame them.
You were pretty mad, too.
I was a little mad. I had to take, especially because I kept telling you that's not Martin Luther King Jr.
I was just like, I got this.
Yeah, and you didn't have it.
I kept saying, shut up, Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, again, not the feminist icon. Just
so who did I marry?
Your wife.
I get it.
Do you? Because I don't think you do.
Okay, so here's my point before this got accidentally digressy. Sexist and racist.
Yeah.
So I do this really interesting thing where, like, if I am trying something new with health that I'm not sure about, like, health's just an example. That I'm not sure about or I haven't done research yet, but I'm like, hey, I'm going to try this for a day or I'm going to try things in this order. And then Allison's like, oh, I'll try too. I'm like, no, don't do that. And she'll be like, why? And I'm like, because it's stupid. Just let me try and see if I die first. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes when we were talking about getting a dog, where some people wrote in and they have vegan dogs who are totally healthy. And some people are like, you have to feed your dogs meat. I was just like, I kind of panicked because I was like, I can be a vegan. And all the scientific research says it's healthier to be a vegan. But I still, when it comes to somebody else, there's still not somebody else, but like when it would come to like a dog or like a baby, for example, there is still part of you that automatically goes into that mindset of status quo of what you're taught, of everything we preach against on the show, because suddenly it's another life. And you just ignore all the facts, right? And you're like, but I was raised this way, so maybe I should just do that. And then
and it's just
later
easier.
In life, we'll become a vegan.
It's easier not to swim against the current, you know, to just do exactly what everybody else does because, you know, everybody's used to that. You can ask anybody for advice.
Right.
Doctors are used to it, you know.
Yeah, doctors, which, by the way, I just had this conversation again. I cannot reiterate this enough. We had I probably shouldn't say that on the show. Hold on. I'm going to mime it to you.
If you have to think of it, you probably shouldn't say it.
A friend who is probably not, right?
Probably not.
Do you get that?
Yeah, I get it. I mean.
And a doctor. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Not really.
Really? We were in this apartment. We're just going to play this guessing game for you guys. Guys, just hold on. We were in this apartment with someone you know.
I have no idea. What
and
you're
someone they
about.
Know.
I have no idea what
Allison,
you're talking
we've had
about.
Like five people over in our life.
I know. I have no idea what you're talking about.
They don't
about.
Live in this state. He's not healthy.
Oh, yeah. I just got it.
All right. So no?
No.
God damn it. Sorry, guys. We'll get this going on the forum. So anyway. So someone on the forum wrote this really sweet email where they're like, we're vegan, we're super healthy, we don't know what to do about our kids because we don't want the societal pressure, we don't want people to think we're bad parents. Yeah. You know, we don't know what to tell them about birthday cake, like all these really sweet, kind of righteous reasons. Like, you could understand where they were coming from. So the post was totally understandable. And I forget what I responded with, but, you know, it is a big concern having parents, because it is so anti-status quo, having parents, you know, look at you and think you're doing something dangerous for your kid, when in reality, you're doing the opposite. I mean, something we haven't talked about in a while is doctors, the amount of nutrition that there are nutritional classes that they're required to take, you know, some places it's optional to even take a course of nutrition.
I don't think most doctors have to take a nutrition class,
and it's a couple hours. Like I said, Allison and I walked outside of our doctor's office, saw people smoking. I don't think anybody was a healthy weight.
There's nothing inherently healthy about someone becoming a doctor. Some doctors eat like shit, they smoke, they drink,
right? So anyway, so I was going to write back, and if anyone knows on the forum, I go emotion first, spell check last, and usually it doesn't even make sense when I try to respond.
Yeah.
Although it's very passionate, and there are lots of exclamation points. So literally that day, our good friend Red, Erin Grayson, who we actually want her to start doing a thing on the forum called Ask Red, because there are so many vegan questions, and she's such an expert on this.
Right.
She posted an article that day written about this exact topic. And I think we're just going to read it because, you know, she says it better than we do. It's from the Girly Girl Army, which is a cool website.
Raising a Child According to Your Values. And it's by a lady named Robin Moore. When I tell people that I'm raising my child vegan, I sometimes feel as though I have to defend and explain my decision. My decision is passive. I'm just leaving out certain foods from her diet. But parents who are feeding their kids meat, dairy, and eggs are actively adding in foods. So shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't they have to defend their decisions to purchase that hot dog that came from a pig whose mother never stepped foot on grass or saw the sky, except from the slot in the truck on her way to the slaughterhouse, and was forced to live in a tiny metal crate amid her own urine and feces, where she was unable to even turn around or take a step forward or backwards for weeks on end? Why don't parents who are feeding their kids meat and other products taken from animals have to defend their decision? They've given their kids cow's milk, which is exactly that, cow's milk. Isn't that a little strange? It's meant to fatten up calves. Humans are the only species that drinks another species' milk, and we're the only species that drinks any milk past infancy. Casino mogul Steve Wine said it best. It's liquid cholesterol.
Ew.
Ew.
By the way, it's Steve Wynn, Allison. I don't know if you're up on your billionaire moguls like I am. If you turn around, you'll see I changed into a tux and a top hat.
First of all, I did notice that. Second of all, how do you know who Steve Wynn is?
I don't know. I saw a special on vegans who are rich.
Okay.
Because they're the ones that matter. It was like him and Bill Clinton. And then also Bill Gates and the founders of Facebook and Twitter. Those crazy assholes.
What exactly is it that people are concerned that my child will be missing out on? High cholesterol, high blood pressure, heart disease, and obesity? It surely can't be protein, calcium, or iron, because there are tons of healthy plant-based sources, spinach, nuts, whole grains, vegetables, beans, and fortified juices, cereals, pasta, etc., that don't have the added fat and cholesterol, not to mention the hormones and antibiotics. The sad truth is, in this society, any behavior or child-rearing decision that goes against the norm is often seen as wrong or irresponsible, even weird. And that's a shame, because it often prevents people, in this case parents, from doing the right thing. Unfortunately, society's backlash is a strong deterrent, and so is the desire to adhere to the status quo. Despite the many studies indicating that vegan diets are not only appropriate for children, but may in fact be healthier, for example, the American Dietetic Association,
hippies,
the nation's largest group of nutrition professionals, stated well-planned vegan diets are appropriate for individuals during all stages of the life cycle, including pregnancy, lactation, infancy, childhood, and adolescence.
Wait,
and for athletes.
Who said that again?
The American Dietetic Association.
Okay, because Steve in the locker room of the Y said to me, "What are you, some kind of queer or something?"
Right.
So I don't know.
I would not weigh those two comments equally.
All right.
Parents are still opting to add animal products to their children's diet, mainly as a result of tradition and being constantly bombarded with messages from the dairy and meat industries. Years of slogans like, milk does the body good, and you need meat for protein, have been drilled into our heads by multi-billion dollar industries pushing their products. If milk does the body so good, then why is it that countries that consume the most milk are also the countries with the highest rates of osteoporosis and vice versa?
America, America.
And the more animal protein that a population consumes, the higher the prevalence of osteoporosis. There is a big protein myth out there, but the fact is Americans eat about 400% more protein than necessary, and even vegetarians eat more than they need. It would be unethical for me to feed my child meat, dairy, or eggs based on what I know about how many animals are raised for food. Or how animals are raised for food. You can look the other way or deny that it's as bad as they say, but the truth is the majority of meat, dairy, and eggs sold in this country come from the animals who have been raised in appalling conditions, in overcrowded, filthy warehouses where they're crammed into small cages and crates and denied basic necessities, including fresh air, sunshine, grass, and companionship.
America.
Simply put, I don't believe that animals should be treated like this, so I'm choosing to leave cruel animal products out of my child's diet. I'm teaching her that if she wants to help end animal suffering and also not knowingly contribute to major environmental problems, including global warming, water and air pollution, deforestation, and soil erosion, she has to be a part of the solution. And that means not supporting it with dollars. This is what it really means to live according to your values. People raise their children according to their own sets of morals and values. Just like a Buddhist wouldn't raise her child Catholic and an environmentalist wouldn't raise his child to be wasteful, I wouldn't serve my child chicken fingers or ice cream. Children are little extensions of ourselves, at least until they're old enough to make their own decisions. In our society, we typically do not allow children to make the decision to participate in anything that is morally questionable until they are of age. Since I consider the way that animals are raised for food in this country to be morally abhorrent, I therefore would not impose animal products upon my child and would not allow her to make that decision until she's old enough to think critically and understand the consequences. So instead of focusing on what my child is not getting, fat-laden, cholesterol-filled slabs of meat, as well as milk, cheese, and eggs from miserable animals who've been raised in terrible conditions, I'm focusing on what she is getting: a healthy, balanced diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, legumes, nuts, what the hell's a newt?
Yeah.
And seeds. And she's getting a whole lot more than that, including a moral compass based on compassion, justice, courage, and integrity. So if you're raising a vegan child like I am, stop being on the defensive and start embracing it. Be proud that you are living with intention and consciously choosing compassion over cruelty.
And then
there is a photo of the cutest baby I've ever seen in my life.
And she has a little shirt that says vegan baby.
And she has a little bow in her hair.
It's a little like, oh, it's
aww,
so cute.
And her name's Charlotte.
By the way, so you read this whole article with so much information, and now all of our listeners are going to be able to picture is cereal with little like faces of Newt Gingrich.
Newt.
That's all I'm picturing now is like just little faces of Newt Gingrich in a bowl of almond milk.
That would be called Newt Bites. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody photoshopped that.
And then it would cheat on its other cereal. Well, that doesn't make sense. So, yes. I thought that was really great for the parents, obviously. And I thought it was a really great refresher on why to be vegan. You know, I mean, there are times where it's just become such a lifestyle for me that I forget that I need to be loud about it, and I forget that I need to be active about it. And I'll read an article like that looking for new information, and then I hear old information, like the way the animals are treated and about how, you know, just picturing like this little pig only being able to see the highway as it's being driven to slaughter. And I'm like, oh my God, that fucking happens? Because sometimes when you do the right thing, you forget about all the bad things that are happening.
Yeah, I always enjoy on the news when the cow gets out of the van and is running on the highway. And
it's almost like they don't like that.
And it makes the news and everybody's like, oh, and they feel bad for the cow. And then, you know, somebody adopts a cow and everybody's like, yay. But it's like, how many cows were driven to the slaughterhouse and killed and that one got loose? Like, if you feel bad about that one cow, you should care about all of the cows.
Right. And we're going to talk about this and a lot of the hypocrisies with Gary coming up. And I think We're gonna go press pause, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna give Gary a call, and then we'll be back with the interview. This show, like all of our shows, was brought to you by Vegan Essentials.
Surprise!
Yeah, I know. For all of your vegan, I don't even want to say vegan shopping needs. Compassionate shopping needs.
Yeah,
because lots of our listeners who aren't vegans make up for being terrible people by buying from veganessentials.com because they support Citizen Radio.
And some of them are working on it. Some have posted on the message board that they're trying to be good people,
and which is really exciting.
Yeah,
and yeah, we're really proud of you guys. And I read every, even if we don't read it on the air, every email that says we got you guys to go vegan just makes me, like, really makes me so happy. So brought to you by Vegan Essentials. And of course, if you want to become a member and support independent media, you can go to wearecitizenradio.com. We're very close to having enough members to go to 5 days a week. We got a bunch of new members, which is really exciting. Thank you especially to our pirates and hoodlums. We know you guys don't have to do this, and you know, it's a lot of money, and hopefully for a good cause, and it means so much that you guys support the show, all of you. Seriously, it means a ton. So we'll be back with our interview with Gary Francione. If you want to read more about Gary, you can follow him on Twitter like we do, or you can get all of his information at abolitionistapproach.com. so it's abolitionist approach.com. And the interview's great. We definitely want to thank him for spending so much time. We actually ended up doing a bonus episode, and we're gonna air his entire 1 hour interview, so you guys get a 2 hour episode
this
today.
Is the extended Citizen Radio. We're like Lord of the Rings.
None of that Daily Show shit where we're like, then check the internet for the rest of it. We make our own rules.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to play the whole thing. And I think you guys will really enjoy it. Not only does he shed a lot of light on animal rights, but also sexism and homophobia. Why not? Blew my mind with something he said about sexism.
Progressive trifecta.
Yeah, so he's pretty amazing. Please check out his website. Support what he does. Check out his books. I'm about to read all of them in the next month. And here's our interview with Gary Francione. Thank you so much for doing the show. We've had lots of requests to have you on since we started talking about veganism, and already there is controversy brewing on the forum, which is very exciting. The first thing I wanted to ask you is fairly simple. What made you want to get involved with animal rights? And talk about one of the cases that made both you and PETA pretty famous with the horrible experiments that were happening with baboons and the sit-in.
Well, let me say from the outset, I didn't want to get involved in the animal rights issue. It just sort of happened. When I was in law school, I had occasion to visit a slaughterhouse, and that changed my life. I had no idea about what went on in a slaughterhouse. I had no idea about how food was produced. My only relationship with animals was eating them. I did not grow up with animals in the house. And as a result, I really didn't ever think about the question. I was involved in progressive social movements when I was younger. And it was largely as a result of that and somebody challenging me and saying one day, you know, you're involved in all these progressive issues, but yet you continue to eat animals. What's wrong with you? You talk about nonviolence, but, you know, you don't practice it. And that conversation resulted in my going to a slaughterhouse, seeing it, and that changed my life. So that's how I got involved. That was in 77, 78, around then. And then I continued to eat some animal products. I ate fish for about another year until I read an article that fish felt pain. I didn't really know very much about animals, and I didn't think that fish felt pain, and I didn't think that they were able to think, and I read some material that made me think otherwise. And I also had never heard the word vegan, to be frank. I was not aware that there were human beings on the planet who didn't eat any animal products at all. And I don't think I'd ever heard the word vegan. If I had, it didn't register. And it was only, I guess, in 1982 that I learned about dairy products and the rest of it. And in both cases, it wasn't a gradual thing. I mean, I stopped eating meat, I stopped eating beef and pork and chicken right away. I ate fish for about another year until I learned something more about fish. And then when I learned about dairy products and what was involved in dairy products and that you really couldn't draw a line between meat and dairy, then I immediately stopped eating dairy. And that was, I think, in the fall of 1982. And I have been vegan since then, and I'm not dead yet, which is proof positive that it's not harmful to be vegan. I met the PETA folks when I was in D.C. clerking for Sandra O'Connor in the October term 1982. And it was then that I met Ingrid Newkirk. Actually, she was working at the time for the Washington Humane Society. And I picked up an injured dog outside of the Supreme Court, and I called the Washington Humane Society, and they sent over Ingrid Newkirk to pick the dog up. And she and I got into a discussion, we had dinner that Friday night, that sort of started my involvement with PETA, which lasted until the early to mid 1990s. And in 1984, I was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, and that was when the head injury lab case became public. There was a lab at the medical school, the University of Pennsylvania, that was performing some pretty gruesome experiments on baboons. And someone went into the medical school and removed some videotapes that the researchers themselves had made, and anonymously provided copies to PETA and to me. And the result was we had a campaign against that lab, which went on for about a year. And in July of 1985, a group of advocates illegally occupied the National Institutes of Health for, I guess it was 4 days, and I was the lawyer who represented them. And we negotiated with the National Institutes of Health, and the result was the lab was closed. The lab was closed. It was the first time in history that a lab had been closed for violating the Animal Welfare Act, and you have to try really hard. I don't know what you know about the Animal Welfare Act, but it's really not worth the paper it's written on, and it's a joke. As a matter of fact, it's sort of an insult to call it. It's an insult to jokes to call it a joke, you have to try pretty hard. And Penn actually succeeded in violating the Animal Welfare Act, and that was the first time that a university, an Ivy League university, had a lab closed down for violating the Animal Welfare Act. And then a couple years later, they opened up using I believe it was guinea pigs. And I couldn't get my friends at PETA particularly interested in doing a campaign against their using guinea pigs, because guinea pigs weren't it wasn't the same sort of campaign. And that's actually when I started learning about the politics of animal rights and about how animal rights groups basically package and sell things, and it's got really nothing to do with what's morally right or wrong. It's got to do with what you think you can get donations for. And so the lab opened up again using different animals, but that was, you know, that was an important case because it was an important case because it demonstrated to people that experimentation, which people thought was regulated by some voluminous federal statute, really wasn't regulated at all. And that there were all sorts of violations going on, and it served the purpose of educating the public about the futility of trying to regulate vivisection. But really, that's not just the problem with vivisection. You can't regulate animal experimentation, period, or animal exploitation, period. And the problems that we had with vivisection were just a part of the problem, but in any event, that really got me started in my professional life with the issue, and I worked with PETA until the early mid 1990s, and then we had a parting of the ways.
So what do you think triggers such a strong reaction when people see stories like that or hear about Michael Vick, but it doesn't carry over to the way we treat other animals?
Because we want to eat them. You see, it's very interesting. That's a great question. how many people do you know do animal experimentation? I mean, I work in a university, so I run into them all. I mean, I know them, and I you know, run into them all the time. But if you don't work in a university, how many people, I mean, how many people out there have contact with people who do animal experimentation? It's simply, I mean, you know, we don't really know. I mean, we don't live next to them. We don't socialize with them. We don't encounter them on a daily basis. Animal experimentation is really sort of an abstract thing. It's something that goes on. It's something that a very small number of people do. We can otherize them. We can turn them into enemies. We can have contempt for them because we disagree with what they do. But really, when you think about it, the use of animals in experiments to cure serious human illnesses is the only use of animals we make that isn't transparently frivolous. I mean, I think it's wrong. I don't think it can be morally justified. But I think that unlike 99.99999% of our other animal uses, which are transparently frivolous, which cannot be justified morally at all, which are, you know, they're just frivolous. I mean, eating animals, using animals for entertainment purposes, hunting animals, all of these things are simply frivolous. And vivisection isn't, I don't think it can be morally justified, but at least it's not transparently frivolous. And so it's not something which we all do. It's something which a very small number of people do. So it's easy for people to focus on that. I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting, Allison, is that if you look at the history of the animal protection movement in Britain and the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries, you see that there's a real focus on vivisection. Indeed, it's really interesting how in the 19th century, for example, throughout the 1800s, I guess you could say that. Yes, throughout the 1800s, you would have, you know, progressive social, progressives focusing on vivisection and having rallies against vivisection, and then they would all go to everybody's house and have dinner and eat meat. And so, you know, it's really very interesting how we separate the issue of vivisection, and we say, well, you know, this is a really bad use of animals, but really it represents a very small number of animals, and it's the only use of animals we make that isn't transparently frivolous. The Vick case is also fascinating. As a matter of fact, just today I was writing something about that. The Vick case is really interesting because there is an example of, we get all upset about Michael Vick and his fighting dogs. Now, of course, what he did was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. However, how is what Michael Vick did, how is it any different from what the rest of us do? And the answer is it isn't. I mean, Michael Vick likes sitting around watching dogs fight. The rest of us like sitting around the summer barbecue pit, roasting the corpses of animals that have been treated every bit as badly as the animals that Michael Vick fought.
Right.
So what? I mean, you know, how is Michael Vick any different from us?
At least half of Vick's dogs had a chance.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess you could put it that way, Jamie.
I'm very kidding.
there's something really perverse and weird about the fact that you know. I mean, I remember when Vick signed with the Eagles in 2009. The day that this was announced, I was at a gas station. I was getting some gas, and the guy on the other side of the island, he was getting gas, and he said to me, "He said, hey, did you see what happened about Michael Vick?" And I said, yes, I did. And he said, you know, I'm a big Eagles fan. And he said, but I don't think I'm ever going to be able to go to an Eagles game and enjoy an Eagles game watching that son of a bitch. I'll never be able to forget what he did. And he was just going on and on. And I, you know, I was pumping my gas. And I said, let me ask you a question. When you're watching these football games, are you eating a hot dog or a hamburger or an ice cream cone? And he looked at me. He said, well, sure. And I said, let me tell you. I said, those animals that you're eating had a worse life and a worse death than Michael Vick's dogs. And I said, I don't want to say that Michael Vick did anything good, because what he did was bad. But, you know, I think we have to put it in perspective. It's very easy for us to look at things like dog fighting and not realize that dog fighting and eating meat or ice cream cones or cheese pizzas, really it's all the same thing. Or we focus on vivisection.
Right.
And you know, treat that as somehow, you know, a particularly odious activity, and it is an odious activity, and it is morally unjustifiable, and it is stupid. It's a waste of money on top of everything else, because it's, I mean, I think that it's silly science. But the bottom line is, it's the only use of animals we make that isn't transparently frivolous, when most of the activities that we all engage in are transparently frivolous.
Right. Quick side note, nothing makes me happier than the thought of the guy at the gas station. Out of anyone he could have brought that up to, it was you.
I know. The poor guy. You know, it was interesting because it was clear he had never thought about that question. And when I raised that with him, and you know, what's really interesting is you can engage people on this issue. If you don't attack them and you don't, you know, and you're not in a position of being perceived as judging everything about them, you could really engage people in this. And it becomes clear people have never really thought about these questions yeah. before. And I'd like to think that, you know, that I provoked him into thinking about something that he hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those are the emails we get the most, people who are like, I would have never considered doing it. And then all it takes is them learning about it. I want to get into that a little later about kind of mm-hmm. the best approaches. But for now, just to, you know, according to many vegan health myths, I'm surprised that you as a vegan even had the strength to pick up your phone. So congratulations. So if you can muster up the energy, could you explain the health problems with eating animals and some of the perks of being a vegan?
Well, look, you know, I'm not a medical professional, but, you know, it seems to me that all you need to do is read, and everything you read indicates that animal products are detrimental to human health. I mean, they are connected with higher rates of cancer, with heart disease, with all sorts of problems. And I can tell you, I have been a vegan, as I said, for almost 30 years now. And everyone in my family has high blood pressure and high cholesterol and whatnot. I have low blood pressure, low cholesterol, and I cannot remember the last time I was ill. I teach at Rutgers. I teach people who are young enough to be my children and are rapidly getting to the point where they are young enough to be my grandchildren. And I have more energy than most of them. And it's really quite remarkable, that the health benefits of a vegan diet are just, in my judgment, I don't see how you can even question it. I mean, it just seems like a no-brainer. It really does.
Right. Does it frustrate you that the liberal community, which supposedly is a party of sticking up for the little guy, still eats animals? Like, Jamie and I constantly feel like the outcasts when we're with our Democratic friends because they all still eat steaks.
It drives me nuts. It really does. It drives me crazy. And I was just today, I was having a conversation with someone about the Huffington Post. and about how the Huffington Post really sort of typifies in many ways the noblesse oblige. I mean, they will have people on there who are talking about treating animals better and promoting better standards for exploiting animals, but they by and large they don't. I mean, the liberal, the progressive community, it just. Flees from the issue and buys into this idea that, well, the solution is to go to Whole Foods and buy our animal compassionate meat or, whatever. I mean, it's this idea that, and unfortunately, the large animal organizations promote this. I mean, they promote that, the large animal organizations are basically in a position, they're somewhat similar to the Catholic Church of the medieval time, selling indulgences in the form of happy meat labels and things of that nature. And they all do this. I mean, they all promote these happy meat labels and happy dairy and happy eggs and all this sort of stuff. And this then is something that, you know, the progressive community says, oh, yes. Well, this is just great. We can be conscientious omnivores because we have progressive people like Peter Singer and Jonathan Safran Foer and Michael Pollan and all these progressive people telling us that we can satisfy our moral obligations by being conscientious omnivores and buying animals who have been treated humanely. And I just think that's nonsense. I really do. I think that's. But you know, look. In fairness, though, the liberal community, the progressive community, whatever you want to call it. They're just accepting what progressives have been saying for the past 200 years about animals. I mean, because, you know, you go back to the animal welfare movement starts in the beginning of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, basically with people like Jeremy Bentham, who say that, look, we've got to treat animals well, but it's okay for us to kill and eat them because cows and pigs and chickens, et cetera, they don't have an interest in continuing to live. They don't care that we use them. They only care about how we use them. And so when Peter Singer says that, because that's his position, I mean, Peter Singer's position basically is that animals are not self-aware in the way that humans are self-aware. They don't have an interest in continuing to live. So they're just concerned about being treated well while they're alive and being treated and being killed in a relatively painless way. And killing them per se is not imposing a harm on them. So when Singer says that, he's just basically repeating what Bentham said, you know, in the 1800s. So, you know, this idea, this is a longstanding idea. It's a longstanding speciesist idea that animals have minds which are different from humans, that they don't care that we use them. They only care about how we use them. And then this feeds into this idea that, well, the solution to the problem of injustice with respect to animals is to treat them better and to produce more humane food. And so, you know, yeah, but it's very frustrating. The other thing that drives me crazy is this idea that veganism is elitist. Oh, God, I'll tell you. That just drives me nuts. Because, I mean, there is nothing more elitist than the idea that my palate pleasure or sense of fashion can justify my imposing suffering and death on a vulnerable being. There is nothing more elitist than that. Right. But you get this idea that, well, you know, veganism is elitist. Now, I think some of that comes from the fact that, I hear this from students all the time. Isn't veganism elitist? And, you know, they're basing their views on, you know, they're standing at a checkout line and at Whole Foods, and they pick up a copy of Veg News and read about, you know, my $25,000, you know, vegan wedding in Hawaii or whatever, or they look at the prices of processed vegan foods. I mean, processed vegan foods are expensive. Many of them are. They're also nutritionally useless. They have lots of salt. And the bottom line is that a vegan diet is actually much cheaper than a diet that has animal products. If what you're doing is eating fruits, vegetables, and nuts and grains, you can do that very, very cheaply, more cheaply than you can a diet of animal products.
Right.
And so, you know, but you know, you get this idea that, well, it's elitist. And that just crazy in my view. Crazy.
Right. It's elitist not to hurt animals. This kind of ties into what you were talking about with the happy meat or the free range eggs. And I think a lot of people, again, are just kind of ignorant on it. And they're like, well, I'm going to eat meat, so I might as well reduce the suffering. So I want you to talk a little bit about the realities of it. So I will be your average Brooklyn liberal, and I come up to you, Gary, and I say, hey, why don't you chill out? I don't support factory farms. I voted for Obama. I only eat free-range eggs and organic meat, so I'm better than most people. Your response?
Nonsense. First of all, the free range foods that you're talking about are the happy meat, happy dairy products, whatever foods, are really no better than the conventionally produced foods. Are egg batteries horrible? Yes. Are cage free eggs significantly better? I don't think so. I've seen a couple of cage free operations, and they seem to me to be one large cage. I don't really see, to me, the difference between a conventional battery egg and a cage-free egg is the difference between a waterboard at Guantanamo Bay that has padding and one that does not have padding. I mean, that's the difference. I mean, you know, is it better to be waterboarded on a waterboard with padding? You know, and the answer is, well, I guess so, but, you know, it doesn't really significantly or qualitatively change the fact that we're talking about a form of torture. So do battery eggs involve torturing animals? Yes. Do cage-free eggs involve torturing animals? Yes. Do free-range eggs involve torturing animals? Yes, particularly since free-range has no specific meaning anyway, and that basically free-range, for all intents and purposes, means that animals have some opportunity to experience the environment outside of the barn. So there is generally a little area attached to the barn, which has some netting over it or whatever, and a certain number of animals can circulate through and be in there for a few minutes, and then they go back in and others go out. Is that better than never seeing the outside? And the answer is, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I guess. But I also think that we delude ourselves into thinking that these alternative, supposedly more humane production methods mean that animals aren't being tortured. That's nonsense. They are being tortured. And I think it's really sad that you have these animal organizations which are promoting the idea that there are abusive and non-abusive ways of raising animals for food. That's nonsense. Mm. It's all torture. It is all torture. So when someone says to me, well, I eat cage-free eggs, I mean, I try to be, you know, engaging to people, and again, you know, because I think that that's important. When you're talking with people about this sort of thing, you have to realize that, you know, animal exploitation is pervasive. People speciesism is pervasive. So you have to sort of assume that that's your starting point with people. So if somebody says to me, you know, I eat cage-free eggs, I might joke with them and say, that's a shame. Why do you do that? And I'll say, well, you know, but isn't that better? I mean, isn't that a good thing to do? Those animals aren't tortured the same way that battery cage eggs hens are tortured. I'll say something like, well, you know, they're all tortured. It is a question of whether or not you're tortured while, your favorite piece of music is playing, or you're tortured when it's not playing. I mean, I guess if I were being tortured, I would prefer, all things being equal, to have, Pink Floyd's The Wall playing than not. But that's not going to really significantly change it from being tortured.
Right. Talk about some of the popular myths when it comes to animal experimentation.
Popular myths, did you say, Austin?
Yes.
Well, there are a number. There are lots of myths about animal experimentation. I mean, one of which, there are two sort of broad questions when we're talking about animal experimentation. There are two sorts of broad questions. One set of questions is it empirically necessary? Do we need, as an empirical or scientific matter, to use animals to get data to cure illnesses, human illnesses? And the second question is, if it is, assuming arguendo, that it is necessary, is it morally justifiable? Now, I think there are lots of myths that swirl around both sort of sets of issues. With respect to the empirical questions, many people think that if we don't have animal experimentation, that we'll, you know, there'll be tremendous detriment to our health, and that, you know, we will not be healthy if we don't have animal experimentation. We need it. And I think that's naive in lots of ways. I mean, first of all, we live in a world of limited resources, and there are many different ways of solving problems. And by assuming that animal experimentation is the way to do it, we make assumptions that sometimes mask very important political considerations. For example, if you want to decrease the new cases of AIDS, of the HIV virus, you can do that most effectively through safe sex education, needle distribution, and condom distribution. As a matter of fact, if we took a fraction of what we put into animal experimentation for AIDS, and we put that into safe sex, needle distribution, condom distribution programs, we would decrease the new cases of HIV AIDS dramatically. But that's not politically feasible. We can't do that. So what do? We say, well, we're going to spend, you know, zillions of dollars in doing animal experiments. And in fact, in vivo experimentation, that is, you know, using animals in experiments for HIV AIDS, has resulted in really very little of use. Most of what we know about HIV AIDS has come as a result of people who consent, because there are no shortage of people who want, you know, human beings who have the virus, who will consent to being experimented on or having data derived from them, etc., because they realize that this is, you know, for many of them, it's going to be a life and death situation. So much of what we know as a result of people who participated in trials of drugs, for example, because that was the only way that they were really going to, I mean, many of the data that we got that resulted in these drugs that we have now came about as a result of people who volunteered for those drug trials because they were dying. We know very little as a result of animal experimentation. And the bottom line is that, you know, whenever, you know, it was like when tuberculosis, you know, was a very serious problem. Researchers knew that, you know, that, and people knew that workers were in particularly hazardous situations. They were being exposed to all sorts of environmental things that were causing them to get ill. Well, you got a couple choices there. You can say, okay, we're going to shut down the factories, but capitalists don't want. The problem is that's not an acceptable solution in a capitalist economy. We're not going to say, oh, okay, fine. There's all of this illness going on, so we're going to shut down these industries.
Unless it's a union factory, then they will shut down.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And you know, we're not going to shut down these factories. What we're going to do is we're going to stick a bunch of animals into cages and try to understand the causal mechanisms. Well, you know, there are all sorts of ways of solving problems, and so to the extent that our choice of animal experimentation is a political choice. As much as it's an ostensibly scientific one. So even if there is a scientific basis, and I don't believe there, I mean, I think if you look at the history of medicine, you can see that reliance on animal models has been counterproductive in lots of respects. I mean, the paradigmatic example that's given is thalidomide. You know, animals were used to test thalidomide, and yet, it resulted in all sorts of birth defects in humans. And that's the example that's given all the time. Well, they did animal experiments, but there are lots and lots of examples. I mean, for example, cigarette smoking. I mean, they couldn't replicate lung cancer in beagles. And so as a result, people were saying for a long time, well, there's no causal mechanism between smoking and lung cancer, even though everybody knew it was getting everybody sick.
Right.
But because they couldn't replicate it in beagles, then, you know, the cigarettes continued to be marketed, and people continued to say that, well, there's a dearth of evidence here that connects causally smoking cigarettes with lung cancer. So the reliance on animal models has actually been counterproductive.
Right.
But even if it were scientifically sound, the use of animals in experiments to solve a particular problem, health problem, oftentimes, almost always represents a political choice as much as it does a scientific one.
Yeah. I mean, now we also have generations of smoking beagles, which is incredibly upsetting.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
I wanted to talk about pets. This is actually something we've been talking a lot about on the show. Do you think it's moral to buy or own a pet that was breeded, and then what are also that was bred, and then what are also your thoughts on pet adoption and how important that is?
Well, I think it's pet adoption is extremely important. First of all, let me say, I'm opposed to all domestication, so I don't think we should be producing any more domesticated non-humans. And that means cows, pigs, chickens, etc. We ought to take care of the ones we brought into existence, but we ought not to bring any more into existence. However, that also includes dogs and cats and the animals that we use as non-human companions. I don't think we can justify domestication. Now, I have 5 rescued dogs that we live with. They are dogs that would have been dead if we didn't take them. And I love them. But in my ideal world, we would not live with other animals. There is something that is really troubling. I mean, I love my dogs, but the bottom line is I control every aspect of their lives. I control when they eat, when they drink, when they go out. I have to, remember during the day when I get involved in something that, I've got to feed them. I've got to make sure they've got water. I've got to take them out for a walk. I mean, they're completely dependent on me for every aspect of their lives. I mean, they live in this sort of nether world of vulnerability where they're not human and they're not really animals. And they're these domestic slaves or whatever. And some of us slave owners are better than others of us. But, the bottom line is that, we really shouldn't be bringing domesticated animals into existence anymore at all. I do not believe there's any such thing as responsible breeding. I mean, people talk, again, there's another example of these these crazy campaigns that animal groups promote, like say, well, you know, we've got to stop puppy mill breeding. Now, of course, I think puppy mill breeding is terrible, but I also think so is responsible. There's no such thing as responsible breeding. You know, responsible breeding is similar to talking about, you know, humane exploitation or rational conservatives. Only kid. And you know, it's just, it's an oxymoron. You know, I just don't think that, you know, we should be breeding animals at all. Having said that, we have tons of them that we have brought, you know, brought into existence as a result of our irresponsibility, and I think we have a moral obligation to take care of them. That's why I have five. I never planned on. Actually, we've had as many as seven dogs, I never planned on having that many, actually. But there are lots of them that need, you know, that need homes. And every night on my Facebook page and on Twitter, I put out the New York City kill list from the ACC in New York City, which is a disaster. I don't mean to insult disasters, but I mean what goes on in New York in terms of the number of animals, the number of healthy animals that are killed every single day, it is absolutely appalling. And I put that information out every single night. As a matter of fact, it will be coming out probably shortly after I get off the phone with you. And I put it up on Facebook, and I put it up on Twitter, and I beg people to adopt. I mean, because those are animals, those are beings who exist now, who have an interest in their lives, and we have an obligation. They're here as a result of our selfishness, and we have an obligation to bail them out, to do what we can to bail them out. And so I believe that we ought to adopt any animal we can. And you know, even if you don't have, you know, excess money or space or whatever, you can't do a dog or a cat. You know, there are lots of other animals who need to be adopted. There are mice, there are rats, there are ferrets, there are fish, there are, you know, all sorts of, you know, rabbits, lots and lots of animals who are brought to shelters, and many, 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 many are killed.
We have a lot of listeners who write in and say they want to go vegan, but they can't because of money issues, or they're still living with their parents, or they don't want to stand out at work outings. What would you say to them to motivate them to become vegan?
Well, you know, the bottom line is you got to decide how important morality is to you, because you could say the same thing, Allison, about, well, you know, I don't want to, you know, I see that question as being no different from somebody saying to me, well, what do I do, you know, if I'm out with my friends and they want to go and patronize some form of sexist entertainment. They want to go to some strip club or something like that. And I feel uncomfortable about raining on their parade. The answer is, look, you got to decide how important morality is to you. If you're worried about people judging you and you're going to do the wrong thing because you're afraid of standing out in the crowd, then that makes me very sad for you, because we are able to behave morally. As a matter of fact, that may be one thing which distinguishes human animals from other animals, in the sense that, although I do think other animals are altruistic, it's unclear what goes on in the minds of other animals, but we clearly are able to make moral decisions. And I think that that's a wonderful thing, and I think we ought to exercise that faculty every single second of every single day, and that we ought to do what's morally right. And so the fact that, you know, I might feel uncomfortable because you make a racist comment and I don't want to call you on it, I ought to call you on it. Or if you make a sexist comment, I ought to call you on it. And I ought not to worry. The problem, you know, the problem with life is that, you know, we let these things go by, that we don't speak up about the little injustices that we see on a daily basis. That it's easy for us to sit back and say, oh, you know, this tyrant is a bad person, or that tyrant's a bad, it's easy for us to sit back as an abstract matter and talk about, abstract people. You know, it's easy to talk about Adolf Hitler, you know, and say, oh, well, you know, he was a really bad guy. Well, yeah, he was a really bad guy, but he got away with what he got away with, because a lot of people just let things go on a daily basis and sort of never called anybody on anything. And a culture of hatred developed as a result of that, which then facilitated somebody like Hitler coming to power. I mean, he just didn't drop out of the sky. I mean, there was a social context in which he arose. And so, you know, it's the same thing, you know, when if someone makes a racist comment or a homophobic comment in my presence, I'll call him on it. You know, again, you know, the point is not to humiliate people or to have a sort of a moral one-upsmanship, but to sort of point out to people that, you know, certain expressions that people use or certain attitudes, certain things that they say are offensive and morally problematic, and that we really have an obligation to call people on those things. So I would encourage people, and I understand, I do, I mean, I understand that a lot of people feel uncomfortable about this, but, you know, if you think it's hard to be a vegan or to express your vegan views, imagine how hard it is for the animals that we don't express those views. I mean, I don't think people really understand. I mean, they may understand an abstract way, but they don't really understand what we're doing to 56 billion animals. That doesn't count fish. 56 billion, I mean, that's a huge number of animals every year that we are killing just for food. That doesn't include sport hunting or entertainment or vivisection or anything. Just for food, 56 billion. And it's a horror show out there. And so, you know, however uncomfortable we feel about speaking up, the victims of our not speaking up are suffering much in a much more profound way than we will suffer as a result of speaking up and feeling awkward. Now, other issues you've raised about, you know, what do you say to somebody who says, well, you know, I want to be vegan, but it's too expensive. I just don't think that's true. I mean, I think that, again, if it's you want to buy processed vegan food, a lot of that stuff is expensive. But eating fruits, vegetables, nuts, and grains is not expensive at all. As far as, you know, having your parents control what you eat, parents do all sorts of things they shouldn't do, and it's the obligation of all right-thinking young people to be subversive.
Right. Now, that would have been a beautiful way to end the interview, but I wrote these questions in a terrible order and decided to make the last question about PETA. So here we go. You know, I get torn when it comes to PETA because a lot of the stuff you've written, I totally agree with. You know, I'm not a fan of the sexism, although we had the VP from PETA on here and we called him on it, and he claims that there are as many naked boys in the ads, which I don't know if that's true. I haven't gone back and counted.
It wouldn't matter because men can, in a patriarchal society, men cannot be the victims of sexism in the way that women are victims of sexism. I mean, it's like racism. You know, people of color can have all sorts of attitudes about white people, but if people of color are not in a position to do anything detrimental to white people, it doesn't really matter what the hell views they have,
right?
Does it? I mean, you know, and so I just don't think. I mean, the idea. I don't think empirically that there are an equal number of men in the PETA ads. But even if that were the case, it really wouldn't make a difference.
Right.
What PETA's doing is commodifying women, and the problem is commodification. And you know, I remember, you know, years ago having this argument with Newkirk when this was first proposed, and we had long discussions, somewhat heated about this issue.
Yeah.
And I continue to believe then, as I believe now, that the problem is commodification. If we continue to treat women like meat, we are going to continue to treat animals like meat.
Right.
And the idea that people don't see that and see that clear connection is just astounding to me. But, you know, so go ahead, continue about PETA.
Yeah, sure. So we also really, you know, and we're going to lead people to your books and your website to read about this whole welfare versus abolitionist approach. We just wanted to tease it here and send people your way. We really both agree with that. However, like, we've talked to a lot of, you know, we've had a lot of bigger bands on the show, and we've talked to them about PETA and this PETA controversy, and they said that they agree as well. But the one thing that these kids, and we know a lot of great people from PETA, and the one thing that these kids are good at is apparently, especially at concerts compared to other organizations, when they table, they're really good at recruiting young vegans. So that's a positive. But then conversely, we've also had conversations with people stop where when you try to argue with them about being a vegan, they'll just throw all these awful things that PETA does as their argument why they're not a vegan. It doesn't really make sense, but they use it. So, you know, do you think that the good work they do is worth it? So, you know, besides the animal welfare stuff. And then, you know, what do you think is the best way for animal rights groups to communicate? And feel free to touch on some of PETA's, you know, the welfare versus abolitionist approach as well.
Why don't you ask a simple question? I'm only kidding. That's a complex question.
That was like 12, right?
Yeah, it was like 12. It was like 12 complex questions all rolled into one hugely complex question. All right. Well,
if only I was the guy at the gas station, and that was my question to you.
Let me try to unpack that. I think bottom line is I think PETA is a terribly reactionary, counterproductive organization. I was involved with PETA in the early 1980s. It was a much more, I think, progressive organization when it started, and I think it lost its way as it got larger and it got richer. I think it really lost its way, and I think that in order to understand, I mean, look, PETA is killing what 93%, 95%, whatever the percentages are. I think they go up and down every year, but they, you know, they're in a very high range of the number of animals that they kill that they rescue. Now, I think. You don't really need to know very much about an organization. If an animal rights organization is killing 95% of the animals that it supposedly rescues, I think that's a huge problem. And that's not a problem which is a recent problem. It's been going on for years, actually. That was one of the things I write about in Rain Without Thunder, is that when PETA had the no-kill sanctuary, Aspen Hill, in the early 1990s, they were killing healthy animals there too, and that was an issue of contention between us, because I don't believe that, I believe if animal rights means anything, it means you don't kill a healthy animal because it's inconvenient or expensive to take care of that animal. Those are never good justifications for killing. And so I think that there's a really serious problem with the number of animals that PETA rescues that it kills. I just have a serious problem with that. We've just talked about the sexism. With respect to the promotion of welfare, this is true of PETA. It's also true of every other animal organization. In order to understand the failure of animal welfare reform, you have to understand the basic economic problem. Animals are chattel property. They're economic commodities. They have an economic value. They don't have any inherent value. They have only an extrinsic, external economic value. It costs money to protect animal interests. So, as a result, the only time we protect animal interests is when we get an economic benefit from doing so. As a result, animal welfare reform is basically, you know, animal welfare regulations or standards provide a very, very low level of protection. Basically, what animal welfare reform requires is that you exploit an animal efficiently, i.e., you protect the interest to the extent that you have to in order to get that animal to market in an economically efficient way. And we've had animal welfare for 200 years now. We're using more animals now than in more horrific ways than at any point in human history. Animal welfare is an abject failure. It is a complete failure. If you look at the sorts of campaigns that these animal welfare organizations promote, you can see what I'm talking about. I mean, for example, in 1958, you have the Humane Slaughter Act. Why is that passed? It's passed because animals, if you have a cow or a pig or a calf hanging upside down who's conscious, they move around a lot. And when they hit workers, they cause injury. And they also incur lots of carcass damage. Not that anybody cares about the workers, but you care about the economic consequences of worker injuries and lawsuits and things like that. And you worry about carcass damage. So they passed the Humane Slaughter Act in 1958 in order to deal with those problems, and that law requires that animals be rendered unconscious before they're shackled and hoisted and cut into. Chickens aren't included under the animal welfare, under the Humane Slaughter Act. Why not? Because they're little, they're small, and at the time in 1958, you don't really have the sense that, you know, there's a lot of carcass damage or worker injuries that result from the chicken industry, or at least that would be avoided in an economically efficient way by applying the Humane Slaughter Act. Now you have this campaign that a lot of these organizations, including PETA, are promoting to gas chickens. Well, let me tell you something. If you were going to start a chicken slaughtering operation tomorrow and you didn't use gassing, you would be economically irrational, because gassing is a much more economically efficient way of killing chickens, and recent agricultural economic studies indicate that you actually cut down dramatically on carcass damage to chickens if you use gassing rather than electric stunning. So most of these campaigns that are being proposed by PETA, HSUS, Farm Sanctuary, Mercy for Animals, all these organizations are promoting various reforms that will do nothing more than make production of animal products more economically efficient. So in other words, what the animal movement has become is a sort of an advisor to the exploitation industries, saying, hey, look, we can help you make your production methods more efficient. There will be arguably a welfare benefit. You'll actually enjoy a production efficiency benefit. We'll be able to go to the public and package and sell a welfare reform that we've gotten. And it's a win-win situation for everybody except the animals, because these reforms basically do really very little in terms of improving animal welfare. And what they end up doing is making people feel more comfortable about continuing to consume animals.
So do you think that the good that they do is worth it, and there's possibly a way to, you know, so to speak, reform the reformers?
No, the one thing that I've learned in my these many years doing this is that once this stuff becomes a business, and once these organizations become organizations that have lots of employees, and they all function the same way. They all package and sell single issue campaigns, welfare campaigns, all of them, every single one of them. Is there some way to change that? Unfortunately, I don't think you can. I don't think you need them. I mean, if you think about all of the money that PETA takes in, you don't really need multi-million-dollar corporations like that for social change. If this is ever going to change, it's going to change as a result of grassroots advocacy activism. And I see what we've been doing. You know, when I wrote Rain Without Thunder in 1996, which criticized the movement exactly on these grounds, which basically said this welfare reform can't be justified, and we ought to move away from it. We ought to move away from promoting violence. We ought to move away from, it ought to be a movement of nonviolence and a movement of non-cooperation with exploitation. People got upset with me, and they stopped inviting me to conferences and whatnot, which was fine. I didn't want to go to them anymore anyway. But people got upset. They didn't like that book, and as a matter of fact, they got very upset about it. And then the internet came along, and the internet has been a remarkable tool for political social organization, because we're no longer, and it's not just in the animal movement, it's in everything. People are no longer dependent on being within the sphere of these entities, these big entities. They're no longer dependent on those big entities in order to be able to communicate with other like-minded people. The opportunity costs of communication have been lowered dramatically as a result of the internet. I'm a professor at Rutgers. I don't have an organization. I don't solicit nor do I accept donations. I'm a professor. I have a website. I have students who work with me on a volunteer basis. I have other people who work with me on a volunteer basis. And, we started that website, abolitionistapproach.com, in 2006. And it has taken off, and there are now movements in just about every country, abolitionist movements in just about every country, that are based on this notion that we've got to stop spending time and resources on promoting these welfare campaigns. We've got to stop these campaigns to get padding on the water boards at Guantanamo Bay, and we've got to have grassroots activism that, you know, that's focused on animal use and on the injustice of animal use. And these organizations are springing up all over the place, and people are doing their tabling, and they're going out on weekends, and they're providing samples of vegan food to people so that people can see that vegan food's really palatable and, you know, it's really great and stuff like that. People are doing all sorts of creative, nonviolent, vegan educational activities. And when I say vegan, I don't mean just in terms of diet. I mean in terms of eating, wearing, using, consuming animals. I mean, they're really trying to shift the paradigm on a grassroots level. That's how it's going to work. Once you start a business, once you start your 501c3, once you start soliciting donations, then you have a lot of pressure to make your donor base as big as possible. And then what you end up with is something like PETA, which tries to be all things to all people and ends up being nothing to anyone, because it basically is, it's an organization. PETA has become an organization that is focused on PETA. Anybody who really thinks that this, you know, the sexism business and a lot of these campaigns that they have nothing to do with animals. They stopped being about animals a long time ago. They're focused on PETA and on the aggrandizement of PETA. Once you're doing that, you've lost sight of what's going on here.
Well, listen, it's so important what you're doing. Of course, if there's anything Allison and I can ever do or promote for you, we are complete and total supporters. Thank you very much again for doing the show. And, just keep up the amazing work.
Thank you.
And keep up Citizen Radio. Keep up Citizen. I was watching Allison this morning on Democracy Now, and you did a hell of a job on that, I must say.
Thank you so much.
You got a huge amount of information out in a very short period of time. But as I was watching it, I was thinking, I live in a world in which people say it's all right for us to eat animals because we're rational and they're not. Now, I don't think that, A, I think animals are rational. B, if they aren't rational, that still wouldn't justify our treating them as things. But C, we think of ourselves as rational animals, and yet I live in a world in which people watch Glenn Beck and they don't watch Amy Goodman.
Right.
And I'm telling you, that sort of completely disproves the notion that we're rational animals. So the idea of what you people are doing in terms of getting information out that the large corporate-owned media simply won't touch, that's really that's important. That's extremely important.
Wow.
Not bad, right?
Yes. So good. And it was like we talked about before the interview. We're like, I've just been a vegan. And then you hear stuff like that. And
it re-energizes you.
It really, really does.
Yeah.
I'm going to start harassing people at outdoor cafes.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary, for charging our batteries.
This is how much Gary likes animal rights, or how passionate he is about animal rights. So he calls me.
Yes.
About 5 minutes after we're done.
Not even 5 minutes. 30 seconds to 2 minutes.
Right. First of all, he emails and he's like, was that okay? And I was like, of course, it was amazing. And I realized it's always the talented people who ask that.
Of course.
If someone gets off a stage and is like, fucking nailed it again. No, they didn't. They're really boring and really generic.
Wow, you've been perfect every time ever since you've started.
Man, you're like a fucking genius.
Sounds like you've grown a lot.
You should be a billionaire. And
you probably will be. Tear.
Oh, sad. Hi, Dane Cook. So anyway, so he says, he was like, when you just care about something so much, you want to be a good ambassador for it,
right.
And so he goes, so we do an hour interview and he goes, can I add something? And we already started uploading and I panicked and I was like, no, but I can try to paraphrase it.
Yeah.
And then we just started having like this really nice conversation while Allison was getting ready to leave the house, about animal rights. And essentially, he was talking about how he knows that not everyone's going to become a vegan.
Sure.
And because lots of people may have listened to the interview and it's so easy to be like, not everyone's going to become a vegan, yawn, done.
Right.
But the point is the people who do care, the people who don't want to spend their lives contributing to the torture of animals – The point is to energize them and to make them excited and to make them active and to make them louder, essentially. And I think he really did it. I mean, he did it with us for sure. And we really hope he did it with you guys. And so, you know, look, progressives, we're already alienated enough by the world, right? You might as well be loud about it and make a difference. Yeah. So thanks again to Gary. Check out his website, abolitionistapproach.com. Go to AllisonKilkenny.com. Check out all of her pieces at The Nation on US Uncut. Check her out on Democracy Now. Right in Democracy Now. Why not? Tell them how excited you were to see her. And that's it. I'll see you guys in Burlington April 9th. My name is Jamie Kilstein.
And I'm Allison Kilkenny.
Now turn off your radio and fuck shit up.